Hey, everyone, and welcome back to The Perspective. I'm your host, Ethan, and alongside me, Thomas Westbrook. Thomas, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, welcome back to The Perspective, a show where we tackle paranormal and supernatural claims, belief in aliens, conspiracy theories, political claims, pretty much anything you want to throw at us, and we apply a skeptic's lens to it. Currently, we have open lines, so if you want to talk to Thomas or myself, give us a call, 951-364-2430. And right now, I am literally sweating bullets. It's this show, there a lot of work goes into it, and it's very stressful, but also very rewarding. But I always get really anxious before the show because I'm like, oh my God, I want it to go smoothly. Thomas, you're frozen. And I want us to get enough callers, make sure everything goes really well.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but you're like blotchy. You keep
why
skipping.
That's happening. It for some reason my computer is being odd.
There we go.
Okay, so now it's working.
Something changed. We do I have a call.
If I we cut out have 10 seconds
screening process. So what's been going on with you and your channel lately?
Well, I'm in the process of working on a video looking at the claims behind the both the historicity and the facts behind the claims made about Jesus. So did Jesus actually exist? And did the things that people claim that he did, is there any evidence that he did those things?
Where are you at on that? In terms of whether Jesus was a real person or not?
Yeah, I kind of take a fairly moderate position, I think. But it's a position that pisses off most mythicists, and it also pisses off most Christians. I think that Jesus absolutely existed, or at least we have sufficient evidence to reasonable certainty say that there was probably a dude that existed named Jesus. He was probably a teacher, some kind of messianic figure, and he probably was charismatic enough for stories to pop up around him, and he most likely died. Beyond that, as far as the miracle claims, the rising from the dead, you know, all of that stuff, virgin birth, I mean, there's just too many instances of people throughout history who have sprung up as cult leaders who have had those types of stories form around them. And, you know, we have examples with like Joseph Smith, with Muhammad, with L. Ron Hubbard, with Satya Sai Baba. Like, so there's so many people who have millions of followers, you know, or even smaller characters who have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of followers. And we know that the stories that spring up around them are not based in reality. And we know that people exaggerate, people lie, big fish stories blow out of proportion. And I think that that's far more likely than that any of it's true. But I do think that he lived.
So I'm curious if this is true. I was reading something the other day that said his original name was Yeshua. And the term Jesus didn't actually, the name Jesus didn't come around until the 1500s. Is that accurate, because they didn't have letter J's that early on?
Well, I mean, yes. So Jesus is actually, it's the same name as Joshua. It was a really, really common name in, you know, ancient biblical times, because, you know, Joshua was obviously a very prominent figure in the Old Testament. A lot of people would name their kids after, you know, scriptural people, just like we do today. You know, we have names that are biblical names, you know, Aaron is a biblical name. Ben is a biblical name. Names like Joshua is a biblical name, you know, and we do that even to this day. And if you look at the history of names in the Middle East, Joshua was like, I mean, probably like 1 in 20 or something. I don't know the exact numbers, but it was one of the most common names. So Jesus was basically just Joshua. And then they were like, Joshua, okay, which one, you know, Joshua, the Messiah, the Christ, you know, Christus or whatever. I think Christus is Greek, but basically like a messianic figure, because he claimed that he was, you know, the anointed one, the chosen one, that according to Old Testament prophecy, the Messiah was supposed to be this great figure that would save the Israelites who were, you know, currently under Roman rule, or, you know, at the time that a lot of the prophecies were made, you know, living in captivity in Babylon, or, you know, under the heel of, you know, various conquering empires. And so, you know, they're like, there's going to be this great, you know, anointed chosen one that's going to come and is going to save us. And for most Jews, it was believed that it was going to be an actual powerful king-like person who was going to drive out the Romans and set up a kingdom on earth. And then when, you know, Jesus comes along and he has a lot of followers and then he dies, they're like, well, that didn't work out, but we still believe he's the Messiah, and they've got to come up with some sort of story. And for a lot of Jews, when the temple was sacked, when Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD, then they're like, well, shoot, there was supposed to be a new king that was going to set up his kingdom here and, you know, have, you know, was going to rule in Jerusalem and be a descendant of David, the great king of old. And all of a sudden their city is destroyed, their temple's destroyed. And so they've got to come up with some way of squaring that circle. And for a lot of people, they chose to latch on to this figure of Jesus and say, like, well, it wasn't a kingdom on earth, it was a spiritual kingdom. He was saving our souls. He's, you know, going to be the he's going to resurrect us at the end times. We're going to have new bodies, a new heaven, new earth. And they came up with various ways of coming to terms with it. And even then, there were so many different, if you look at the old church and you look at old church writings and stuff, and you look at all of the different non-canonical gospels and stuff, there were a million and one different explanations that weren't what we end up with today.
And just for clarity, you, even though you believe Jesus being a historical person was most likely real, you reject any type of supernatural claims around said figure, right?
Well, I mean, for obvious reasons, it's if I say, you know, hey, there's a guy that lives next door to me, he's my neighbor and he lives and he exists, you're probably not going to doubt that. That's not an extraordinary claim. People exist all the time. There's 7 billion people on planet Earth doing it right now. But if I say that my neighbor can turn water into wine and that he can, you know, levitate up into heaven, you're probably going to raise an eyebrow and be a little more skeptical. So until we can actually demonstrate and prove that miracles exist, then pushing it back 2,000 years, I don't think makes it any more likely. I think it makes it less likely, because you have all that time for there to be, you know, copying errors, transcription errors, word of mouth. You know, we don't even get the first gospels until, you know, the first complete gospels until well over a century after the death of Jesus. And, you know, the first writings, you know, the earliest tiny little fragments, we've got like P52 is like the oldest known papyrus right now. There was one that was thought to be earlier, but it was a mistake. They thought that it was a first century Gospel of Mark, and then it turned out to be like 200 years older than they thought. So we have these tiny fragments of John that come around 125 AD. Jesus died about 100 years before that, around 30 AD. And so you have these tiny fragments that have like 4 verses on them. And, you know, or, you know, there's a few other fragments from a few other gospels that are around that time period that are just as small. And then you don't have a gospel for another, you know, 100 years or so. The first complete Gospel of Mark comes around 370 AD. So it's a full, like, okay, you know, 350 years after Jesus died that we have the complete text. And so that's a lot of time for there to be a lot of confusion and people lost in, you know, there's word of mouth and you know how the game of telephone works. Well, imagine that if you have an incentive to change the story because you're trying to not look foolish, you're trying to convince people that it's real, you're trying to convince people and change their mind and win them over as converts. And so instead of just being like, well, you know, Jesus, he had some great teachings, you know, you might say, well, and I heard that he walked on water, you know, and you can see how those stories might be thrown in there in order to kind of drum it up. And even if they were based on, you know, some sort of hint of truth where, you know, maybe Jesus did perform some sort of trick. Like, we know that there were people who performed magic tricks or who perform magic tricks to this day. Mm-hmm. We know that the field of, or the magic industry, you know, is relatively new, but magic as a whole has gone back thousands of years. Like, there are people who doing all kinds of, you know, tricks and sleight of hand and things that, you know, it's not something new. And right. So you combine all of those things together. You know, you have the fact that people, you know, can misremember, people can lie, people can, you know, have false memories. Word of mouth is terrible. There's, you know, a lot of motivation to make up these stories. And it starts to kind of all add up. And this isn't uncommon. You look at other figures at the time, you know, Julius Caesar, after his death, you know, he was talked up as a god, you know, as this divine person who ascended into the sky as a god. And it's like there was motivation for Caesar Augustus, you know, the next, or the first emperor, but kind of the heir to Rome. There's reason for him to make that type of story up because he wants to be seen as divine. And if it's like, yes, the Roman emperors are divine, the first emperor, Julius Caesar, was in fact a god, you know, he has every reason to make that kind of a story up. The same way that, you know, pharaohs and stuff were seen as gods. Like, if you were seen as divine, no one could question your right to the throne.
So we do have a few really good callers, and I wanted to get to one immediately. However, we do have a caller that wants to actually respond to one of your remarks. Okay. They want to point out the miracle that is associated with Jesus. So to the other two callers on hold, please bear with us. I want to grab this one first. Catholic traditionalist, you are on with Thomas and Ethan. How are you?
Hello, how you guys are doing?
Good, how are you?
Oh, pretty good. So you believe in a historical Jesus, but you don't believe that there's any miracles associated with him. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I wouldn't go as far as the mythicists. I think it's a little bit conspiratorial, and I know I'll piss off some atheists saying that, but I do think there was a real guy. I just don't believe in the miraculous.
Same.
Okay. So are you familiar with the Shroud of Turin?
I am.
Okay, so the Shroud of Turin, you know, there's some scientists that have claimed that it's just paint, you know, painted on image. But those scientists that claim that, they're not the ones that had actual access to, physical access to the Shroud. Also, with regards to the 1988 carbon dating test, scientists now are saying to disregard that because they found that there's fibers woven into that cloth to attach it to the actual shroud, because the actual shroud doesn't have those fibers, those cotton fibers, cotton cloth fibers. So apparently that piece came detached. It was detached from the shroud, and so it that would throw off the dating test, the carbon dating test. But just recently, there was a scientist that used a different type of carbon, not carbon dating, but it's a different type of dating that's more specific, uses a type of laser light, where he was able to disregard, negate the cotton fibers. And when that's done, it does show that the shroud does date back to the time of Christ. And so the team that did actually analyze the shroud in the 1970s, they determined, that was the STIRP team, by the way. They had physical access to the shroud. They determined that the shroud itself, the image on the shroud was not formed by any paint, pigment, iron oxide, or anything of the sort, or stains or anything. They determined that it was not formed by any known naturalistic means. And so we have an image of a man that was crucified, which meets exactly the description of the biblical account of Jesus' crucifixion. And we also even have, which was found just a few years ago, under X-ray imagery, they found Jesus' name on the cloth in three different ancient languages. It said Jesus the Nazarene in three different ancient languages. And this was only found under X-ray imagery, because it was so embedded into the shroud. And so we have all this evidence. And oh, and by the way, there's some news reports.
Can I respond to those points before we move on?
You'll see. I couldn't make out what you said.
Can I respond to those points real quick before we move forward?
Okay, yeah, sure, go ahead.
So as far as the dating back in 1988, I am aware that they carbon dated the shroud, and that, you know, they found that what they dated showed that it was 14th century or potentially 13th century. Then I heard that additional, you know, scientists were saying that, you know, they didn't date the whole cloth, and that even though they took multiple samples around the sides of it, because when you carbon date something, the act of carbon dating is in itself destructive. So, you know, if they take a small sample, they're trying to do it without actually destroying the object. And so they're going to take from the sides. I'm not familiar with this form of laser dating that you're talking about. Do you, if you can provide some, like something a little bit more substantial on that, I would really like to look into it more.
Yeah. That was done in 2016, I believe, scientists had gone ahead and used that approach instead of the carbon, the 1988 carbon dating approach, because it's more accurate and it's able to negate things. Unlike the carbon dating test, the laser type of testing is able to negate certain physical things, and yet only go ahead and access those things that it's dating. And so that it gave a more accurate date. And so the carbon dating test, scientists are saying ignore it. Oh, by the way, you have some misinformation about the samples that were taken from the shroud, because it wasn't taken from different sides of the shroud. It was taken from that one corner of the shroud that had those cotton fibers woven in, again, which the rest of the shroud doesn't have.
Okay.
So that would obviously throw off the carbon dating test.
And I'm willing to concede that if that's the case. As far as this new method, I really want to hear more about it, but I'm still, the reasons that I'm still more skeptical is, one, there was a test that was performed here in the last 5 years or so, where there were some forensic analysis experts that came in, and they started looking at the blood patterns on the arms. And they attempted multiple times to recreate something like that through crucifixion wounds, where they attached tubes to their hands where the blood would come out, and they tried holding their hands up at various different angles. They tried, you know, analyzing the type of blood patterns that would come out. And they found that it wasn't in line with anything that we would expect from an actual crucifixion. And so
Yeah, I could respond to that. Sure. If you would have looked into it, you would have seen that other scientists, would refuse to go ahead and publish that in their journals because they actually criticized those particular scientists because those particular scientists actually added chemicals to the liquid, the blood, to make it liquid, have it liquefied. Which, of course, the actual person on the shroud wouldn't have had those chemicals like EDTA. And also, with regards to a man that was a scientist himself said that with regards to a man that is tortured and suffering and so forth, the blood itself would be different and act differently, or it's the way in which it would be shown would be different from another type of corpse's blood. And these scientists didn't take any of this into account. And so there's other aspects of it as well that other scientists said that these particular scientists that put forth that deal trying to refute the shroud didn't take into account. So that's why other scientists refused to go ahead and publish it.
So unfortunately,
now don't get me wrong, it was published in news accounts. Like, you had plenty of for example, newspaper articles about it. But other scientists, their peers, they refused to go ahead and publish it.
My connection unfortunately dropped briefly there. Can you give a quick resummary of the reason why the scientists
sorry about that, CT. He lost connection, so if you could just quickly kind of summarize what you just said or recap as quickly as possible.
I'm so sorry about that. I don't know what's going on with my internet.
Other scientists refused to go ahead and publish it in scientific journals. The article itself was published in many newspaper articles, okay. Mm-hmm. But their fellow scientists refused to publish it in science journals. There might have been like an addendum or something like that or something, citing it. But there was never an actual science journal article on it because their own peers, other scientists, criticized them because, one, they added chemicals to the blood, to liquefy the blood, which, like EDTA, which obviously wasn't found on the Shroud of Turin. And also, when they pointed out the fact that when someone is tortured, and beaten, the blood itself changes with regards to the aspects of that blood, which these other scientists didn't even take into account. And there's numerous other things that these scientists criticized them about, which is why they didn't publish it in any science journal. But sure, you might have seen it in some news article someplace, but you know, like a New York Times or something like that. But you know, and it might have gotten wide press. But when it comes to it being actually a credible scientific claim, their fellow scientists rebuked them on that.
Yeah, I mean, if that's the case, then I'm like. So I've been in kind of this arena for a while where I'll talk about scientific stuff and I'll bring scientists on and I'll talk to experts and then I'll look at the, you know, the perspective of creationists or people who are kind of going against the consensus. And what I've seen time and time again is that if there is a like a new find or a new claim or something that could potentially turn everything on its head and it's submitted for peer review in the scientific arena, if there's a reason why experts say, hey, hold up, there's something wrong with the methodology, there's a reason why you're going to get a false result, I tend to defer to, you know, the experts on that. I'm not a forensic analysis or analyst. I'm not a, carbon dating specialist. You know, I'm not a chemist. But when I see some, you know, people who have spent their entire lives in these fields who actually are reviewing and looking for, you know, problematic errors and stuff with when it comes to, you know, publication in order for a journal to maintain its reputation as accurate, if there's a flaw that they see in the methodology to where they don't want to publish, that raises some serious red flags with me. Now I don't know all of the details behind this one instance, but I mean, I have to be upfront with my skepticism there.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's why the scientists that want to publish that in any other science journals. And also, for example, we see, you know, you'll see other newspaper articles where it says scientist has reproduced the Shroud of Turin. But then when you actually look into it, you find out that these scientists didn't actually reproduce the Shroud of Turin because the scientists used some type of pigment paint or stain or iron oxide or something to create an image on a cloth, which, yeah. Again,
I mean, I'll tell you one thing.
Excuse me, if I could continue, I'm trying to make a point here.
Okay.
So the thing is, which the STIRP team in the 1970s determined that the image on the burial cloth of Jesus Christ, that image has no paint, stains, iron oxide, or pigments of any sort. There is no naturalistic means by which that image is on that cloth. Which if it's not naturalistic, okay, would you agree that if it's not naturalistic, then what's left is the supernatural?
Well, not necessarily. I can't speak.
I'm not sure what you mean by not naturalistic.
That brings me to a question I had from one of the comments you made earlier on. How does one rule out all naturalistic means? Because, I mean, as technology improves, we learn more and more. So how can any scientist right now say, I looked at this and I've ruled out every naturalistic mean?
Well, sure, because they've ruled out every naturalistic means. In other words, every naturalistic means known to man to this date, from the 1970s to the year 2021, to this date, scientists still do not know how it is the image is on that cloth on the Shroud of Turin. Now, there are Italian scientists about a decade ago, or about a little over a decade ago, that they used a laser to put an image on a cloth, and it came within the closest to that of the image on the Shroud of Turin, because it was very small with regards to the depth on the cloth, because the image on the Shroud of Turin is in the nanometer range. However, the Italian scientists themselves admitted that even their laser did not actually create an image like that on the Shroud of Turin, because their image is not in the nanometer range. And they themselves said that in order to get in that nanometer range, they would need a far more powerful laser, which simply does not exist today in our present technological environment.
So my follow-up question to that, you're muted, Thomas. My follow-up question to that would be, just because they don't have an answer now, it sounds like they should be saying, I don't know, and it shouldn't be supernatural is the answer. You should stop at I don't know.
A great example of that, real quick,
saying is there is no naturalistic means that they know of. They're not saying that scientists will never make the claim that it's supernatural. Science can only go ahead and make claims with regards to that which is measurable and testable. So scientists will never say, yeah, this image is on the cloth because of the supernatural. But what they did rule out so far is that they, with regards to the natural, they have ruled out that everything that they know of with regards to the natural could not have made that image on that cloth.
Are you familiar with Damascus steel?
I've heard of it.
It was an old technique used to make swords. And I don't know if it's been figured out yet, but I know that for centuries, it was an absolute mystery to scientists, if not still to this day, where it was, you know, a particular type of steel that, you know, no one knew how they made this steel. And, you know, it makes me think of that, where it's like, just because we don't know the techniques and the blacksmithing techniques of, you know, this ancient culture, that doesn't mean that it's supernatural, just because there's no natural explanation that we know yet. And as far as the Shroud of Turin is concerned, you're not just looking at the techniques of making it. If they used a particular chemical, if they used a combination of chemicals, you know, if they did, you know, any kind of thing to it, you're also looking at how these chemicals would have degraded over time, how they would have, you know, broken down over time into what they are today, you know, because this cloth is, you know, quite old. I think we'd both agree, you know, as far as the exact date of it, I don't know. But to then try to look at something like that in retrospect and say, how can we get to this? Well, we can't perfectly recreate something that's 2,000 years old without actually, you know, putting it in a time machine and you know, sending it off 2,000 years into the future, or aging it the slow way and then checking. Like, it's hard to recreate something like that naturally.
Sure. No, I agree with you with regards to the steel, but ultimately they did determine that it was caused by naturalistic means. With regards to the shroud, they have not determined that it was caused by naturalistic means. And you've never answered my question. If the image on the cloth is not caused by naturalistic means, then would you agree that the only alternative would be supernatural?
I'm not sure what you mean by that. And the reason that I say that is I'm not trying to throw some kind of red herring, but the word supernatural to me is nonsensical, because if it interacts with the natural world, you can't call it supernatural. If it makes a actual physical copy of something on a natural fabric, then it's something that interacts with the natural world, and it's by all means natural. I don't know how you can call it, like, if it's supernatural, okay, it's outside of the natural world, then if it doesn't interact with the natural in any way, shape, or form, then, like, it's no different from something that's completely non-existent to us. There'd be no way of detecting it.
So I have a follow-up question, okay. Thomas. If I just want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly, let's say hypothetically right now I could materialize a book out of thin air. No tricks. Like, legitimately, I had the power to do that. Would that be natural, or would that be supernatural?
Well, if you're doing it in the natural world, then, you know, I would say, okay, you a natural person did something to create a natural object that we can test in the natural world. I don't know the processes by which you did it, whether it was some sort of, you know, quantum fluctuations or, you know, teleportation or some weird method. But I, that would lead me to conclude that I know less about the natural world than I thought I did. It wouldn't make me think that there's like I just definitionally the word supernatural doesn't make sense to me. It's like, what do you mean completely outside the natural world? Like, does it interact with the natural world? And if so, can you really call it detached from the natural and outside of the natural?
Sure, I could define it
Catholic
for you.
Catholic City, we only got about 2 minutes left. We got to wrap up, but I'll go ahead and let you continue.
Yeah, I'd be happy to define it for you. So yeah, like you spoke of yesterday, is it outside? The answer would be yes, because before the natural world existed, there was a supernatural world. There was heaven, there were angels, there's God. So the supernatural is outside of the natural. Natural refers to all of creation with regards to our creation, our environment. Sort of like, you know, a fish in an aquarium, that's its environment. So this universe is our environment. So obviously, if God did create this universe, which he did, then he created it from the outside, and therefore that means that the supernatural can go ahead and work in such a way where it can bring forth not only this universe, but also can part open the Red Sea, or enable a man who is both fully man and fully God to walk on water and to rise back to life after 3 days of being dead. So yeah, the miraculous does take place in a world where God does exist. Yes.
But I still don't see how you can call that supernatural. You can call it outside of our universe. So is that in a multiverse? Is there a additional force that we haven't detected yet with science? That and at what point do you say that that's, once you detect it, once you test it, once you can, you know, account for it, how does that not become part of what is natural and what is normal and measurable and you know that you can, you know, test?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, everything in our universe, so from what we know so far, is testable in the material realm, but the supernatural realm wouldn't be like that.
Okay, so if there's a multiverse that's outside of our universe, is it part of the natural world?
Well, no, I never made the claim that there's a multiverse outside
of our universe. If there was, like for the sake of thought experiment.
Hold on, I'm speaking. Excuse me.
Well, for the sake of thought experiment, like I want to run this out though.
Excuse
for the sake
me. Of thought excuse experiment.
The hosts do run the show. CT, he's not being rude.
That's very rude. If you're going to be rude, I'm just going to leave.
Okay. You've been muted.
I'm trying to take it a particular direction to see like if this actually holds water. And because a lot of times, like if you're not able to probe with questions, a lot of times we can end up going down a million different rabbit trails. And I'm trying to kind of guide it, you know, to see if even the notion of the supernatural is something that holds water. And I don't think that it does.
He dropped after being muted. Yeah,
that's unfortunate.
Keith Heath, thanks for the $5 super chat. Before the natural world, there was a supernatural world, heaven and hell. That is one hell of a presupposition. Let's talk about your axioms. Hmm. Ready to get to the next call?
Sure. I want to say one thing about the Shroud of Turin that to me is kind of nail in the coffin that it's a hoax. You look at the face on the Shroud of Turin, and it looks like something that someone in like first year art class would draw. The proportions from the, you know, bridge of your eyes to the top of your head, you know, down nose to your chin. It's not a normal human facial proportion, like not even remotely. So, yeah.
Okay, cool. So next caller, I'm excited about this one. Well, I'm excited about both our callers, but this one believes space is a hoax and not real. Ooh. Peter, you are on with Thomas and Ethan. How are you?
Hey, how's it going, Thomas and Ethan? It's a pleasure to be here. Once again,
it's a pleasure talking to you. Ethan told me that he might have a caller talking about this topic, and so I'm very excited about this one.
Perfect. I'm excited too.
So go ahead, jump into it. Tell us why you think space is a hoax.
Okay, so it all started out, I'd say, when I started converting to a Christian, it was mainly the main reason why I became a Christian. Due to the fact that I was in love with space, I used to always watch all the space documentaries and BBC, Discovery Channel, and all that stuff. And I just one day started realizing that with all these telescopes that they claim to have, like the Hubble telescope and many more that are circling the Earth and stuff, I started to notice that they weren't actually giving us real life feed or footages or pictures of space. It all turned out to be CGI, computer made, kind of like a bit of cartoonish. And the colors are amazing. It's beautiful to see all those space documentaries. But if you're only seeing like CGI, man-made computer edited images, it kind of made me start questioning what's really out there, or if there's anything even out there. And that's when I got into becoming a Christian. I started reading scriptures, and it turns out that I actually have a Bible that has like a dome around the Earth, so we can't really escape. And beyond that dome, there is no space or planets or none of that stuff. It's actually just all water.
So who built this dome? Because I was going to say, what are we seeing when we look in telescopes? But now I'm kind of curious. Well, I guess, yeah, what are we seeing when we look through telescopes? And who built this dome?
I love your questions. Thank you so much for always asking amazing questions. So who built the dome? God, our creator, just kind of like how scripture says. I believe the name of the dome is a firmament. What's made out of, I'm not so sure. There's a few scriptures that describe it being like some type of molten glass stretched out in heaven. So that's the reason why when I say it's some type of snow globe or dome or glass, or it could even just be energy, some type of energy just holding waters above our head, which is the reason why when we look up, we see water, so we could see through this firmament. And your other question about what are the lights that we see in the sky, I think is exactly, I don't think they're space rocks or planets or land masses, just like the moon. I believe that they're either some type of like hologram, or there's a scientist that was claiming that the moon was some type of cosmic energy. And the stars seem to be light, kind of what scriptures say to for signs and seasons. So we see certain constellations in certain areas, we know that it's like April, or we know that it's like summer, winter, and these constellations always stay the same. We're never getting new ones. It's been the same one since ancient times.
So what happened 2 weeks ago when Jeff Bezos shot a rocket into space?
I love that one. So when Jeff Bezos shot a rocket, also with the owner of the Virgin Galactic owner, airplane guy,
Richard Branson.
So yeah, exactly. Thank you. So what's going on with them? It's kind of like a hoax. So you know how like I said that we're trapped in a dome. They're basically flying as close to the dome as they can, but they can't go any further than that because we're trapped in there. Nothing could penetrate that. Not even missiles or nothing could penetrate the dome. It's too powerful of a structure. And I believe that there's records of the government. I think it's called Project Fishbowl, where they're actually trying to blow up this dome with like nuclear missiles and stuff, but they can't even scratch it. So when Jeff Bezos and the other person went flying into this space thing, they're not really flying to space or none of that stuff, because they can't go beyond this firmament. So they're just literally flying as high as they can, and that's just what it is.
So you're saying that all of the live feeds from the International Space Station, that because you determined that one of the feeds wasn't live, which maybe it wasn't, that everything that we know about space from the last 60 years is complete BS. How many people are in on this hoax?
Good question. I believe there's plenty of people in on this hoax.
What's plenty of people? Like multiple countries? Is it governments? Is it private companies?
Yeah, exactly. Private companies, NASA, the Russians, all these are so royal families.
Millions of people or a few hundred people?
Probably several thousand people, to be honest. And they keep it very small within like the elite, like their
group. Well, I mean, I hate to break it to you, but there's more than several thousand people just working at one space company alone. SpaceX has significantly more than that. And it's one small private company or a decent sized private company. NASA's bigger than that. You got the European Space Agency. You got Russia. China just went to the moon and planted a flag on it. You have, you know, dozens of companies that send satellites into space that supply internet access. You know, you couldn't just say that there's a few thousand in on it. Like you'd have to get the numbers up into the hundreds of thousands.
And how could that many people keep that big of a secret?
Good question. You're right. There could be several hundred thousand people, half a million. I'm not so sure.
Now, what's the incentive to keep this a secret? Is it like a religious thing where they're trying, you know, it's trying to promote some, you know, anti-Christian idea? Is it a, you know, political thing where some country's trying to, you know, like for whatever political reason, keep this a secret?
Good question. So based on my knowledge and the stuff that I think why they're doing this is, well, first I'll get on with what you said about how they're sending satellites and we're getting signals. Actually, anything that has to do with space is fake. So satellites aren't even real. Like they're not orbiting. There's not thousands of satellites or space junk orbiting Earth.
Are you calling from your phone right now?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, and does your phone does your phone have a GPS system on it?
Yeah, it does. So
how does GPS work?
Good question. So basically what's going on is that we get most of our signal from cell phone towers and fiber optic cables that are stretched out all through the ocean and the Pacific, Atlantic.
No, I'm not talking about talking about cell signal. I'm talking about GPS specifically. They're two very, very, very different things. And if you study electrical engineering and you learn how, like, and I'm not an electrical engineer, but I know enough about this because I've taken enough classes on it to know that there's a very big difference between cell phone towers and the type of signals that they send and the range that they send and how they're able to triangulate a position versus GPS. And like, you don't get that level of precision, especially like when you go outside of areas where you no longer have cell service, you go out in the country where there are no cell towers, but you still have GPS.
So good question. So you're right. All that done with like triangulation, it's your position locked in within different cell phone towers. But like you said, how is it that like they could like get GPS, like let's say in a mountain, you know, like because when I go camping and that's not even that far outside of LA, maybe like about an hour and a half, I have no signal, you know, and like if satellites were real, I should be getting signal all over the world.
Well, no, but you're not getting cell reception from the satellites. You're getting that from the towers. I agree with you. But the cell reception that you're getting from the towers, if you go on Google Maps and you download the map ahead of time and then you go out into the countryside, no matter where you are, you're still going to get a perfect GPS positioning. You know, as long as you're not like underground or something, as long as you're above ground, you're going to get a GPS positioning based off of your position and other satellites that are figuring out where you are.
Right. Okay. So I once saw a thing where they have these antennas that shoot waves and they bounce them off the firmament. You know how I said that the firmament is like some type of solid structure? So that's how they're able to get signal or GPS signal even when there's no cell phone towers. They have this high frequency antennas that emit waves that bounce off the firmament, so you can get location almost anywhere.
So they're bouncing these waves off of the firmament in order to get your position.
Yeah, I think so. I may not be 100% accurate on that, but I do remember seeing videos and articles about that, how they have like these high frequency antennas that emit waves that are being bounced off, kind of like sonar, off the firmament and into other places where they collect these signals.
So did I understand you correctly earlier when you were saying like what we're seeing in the sky is a hologram, like the seasons and stuff?
Yeah, so it turns out that the moon is not an actual like landmass, because there's occasions where let's say, for example, the moon is like half a moon, kind of like a banana or like a cat's eye, and you could see right through it. You could see a star right through it. And something that's solid should not be something that's transparent.
I'm not sure that I've ever been able to see a star through the moon.
Right. So who's in charge of these holograms? And are they like, I'm really confused on this one. And did you say, is the sun real? Yes or no?
Oh yeah, yeah, they're real. They're real things, but we're not so sure of, like what they are, you know. So it's still a mystery. So basically, another thing that kind of throws me off is like they could be like a cat's eye moon or like a banana shaped moon during the day when the sun is literally right in front of it, and instead of like how they teach us that like we see the moon because it reflects the sunlight. So why isn't it that during the day when it's half a moon, it's not a full moon?
I mean, I can explain that. I can explain that very easily. So let's say, for example, that you have the moon right here. My head is the Earth, right? And so if you have the moon here and you have, you know, the sun way out here somewhere, you know, in the sky that you're looking at, right? If the sun is way off, you know, to the side, it's not hitting both the Earth and the moon at a full, like hitting it to, you know, to light up the full side of it. If the Earth is here and, you know, maybe the moon is way over here, you might be getting only a part of the sun, depending on where the sun is in the sky. You might still be able to see the sun, but it's only hitting the moon at the side of the moon, but you're still able to see that sliver of the moon, even with the sun out. Like the moon is really, really far away from the Earth. And it just depends on the angle. It's hard for me to demonstrate it without like actually showing you like a diagram, but I recommend going online and looking up a diagram of like the solar system and the moon and the planets and like how the phases of the moon are explained.
Yeah,
and
I completely understand. I could 100% know what you're saying. It's a really good point. But another thing that kind of baffles me and throws me off is that why is it that when it's half a moon or the shape of a cat's eye or a banana, why is the other side same color as the background? Why isn't it just a shadow, like a dark? Like let's say if I were to get a basketball and I shine a flashlight just to the half of the basketball, you'll see a basketball that's lit and the other side that would just be dark. But in real life, we never see that.
Wait, what?
We should see like, yeah, okay, so let's say that it's during the day and we look up and the moon is like a cat's eye. Why is it that the other side is missing instead of being a dark shadow?
And I mean, the moon's a lot bigger than a basketball.
No, I know, but it's just like a small reference to it, because even if I had a giant basketball and I shined a light to half of it would be lit and then the other half would be like a dark shadow. But in real life, we don't see that.
Oh, no, but light dissipates, right? So from one side of a basketball to another, you know, if you have a light on in the room, you have a really tiny amount of space between one side of a basketball and the other. And so as light diffuses, it might be a little darker on one side, but it's a very small distance. Whereas when you're looking at the diffusion of light as, you know, the sun rises, if you look at the sun rising, you know, from space over the Earth, you're not just going to see like a straight line of like sun, no sun. You're going to see a diffusion of light where it's a little darker, a little lighter, a little lighter, a little lighter. And that's, you know, miles and miles long. It's a lot bigger than a basketball. But when you go far enough back and you look at it, then that transition period looks a lot more like a line. It looks, you know, it's a lot harder for eyes to distinguish the gradient. It looks more linear.
Yeah. Okay.
We have to wrap up in a moment, but go ahead. We got another minute or two. Peter, what else did you want to say?
I want to say that I want to say that also, like, that the tilt of the earth is I wrote it down. I was trying to get this ready. But the tilt of the earth is, like, I think, like, 23.4 degrees. And when you subtract that with a 90-degree angle, it gives you, like, 666. And then when you get other measures of how fast, like, the earth is rotating and, like, how fast it's traveling, other numbers end up being 666. And it coincides with, like, the mark of the beast.
Can I completely blow your mind here for a second? So there's actually, if you go back and you look at the earliest mention of the mark of the beast, the earliest scriptural mention, textual, and this isn't from, like, secular scholars, this isn't from atheist scholars. Like, I actually learned this from, I believe it was, is his name Daniel Wallace? He's, like, one of the foremost Christian biblical scholars. The original mention of the number 666, if you look at our oldest copies of that, it's actually 616. And so it's like that right there throws a huge wrench in all of these conspiracy theories about the number of the beast. And, like, there's hundreds of volumes written about the number 666 because people look for patterns and they get scared by numbers. Right. But, like, it's when I see something like that, I'm like, it's people want to find things that fit an existing narrative, and you can find numbers in anything. You know, people have done it with the pyramids where they'll divide the height by the width, and they'll, you know, look at the GPS coordinates and the latitude and the longitude and stuff, which, like, you know, they'll do all of these hoops that they jump through in order to get a specific number that to them is meaningful in some way, shape, or form. But if you add up, you know, all of the different ways that we could interpret and divide numbers by other numbers and add things together and stuff, like, you're going to find some special number somewhere sooner or later. So I don't find that convincing at all. What I would recommend is I strongly recommend that if you see something like this, like, you know, why do we only see a sliver of the moon, you know, and the sun is also in the sky, you know, look that up, go to, you know, look at some scholarly articles on it, you know, actually look at what the scientific consensus is and see if it makes sense. And if it doesn't, try to break it down and really understand how they got there, rather than just postulating something that's easy to understand. Cause, like, science is hard. Math is hard. Math is the language of science. But, like, if you can really get to the point where you can start to, like, understand why there's this consensus, then if you have these two competing ideas, look at the two of them, see, okay, does this new model that I'm proposing, does it explain everything else that the existing model currently explains, and does it explain it better? And are there things that this model doesn't explain that this one does? Or do I have to appeal to conspiracy and hundreds of thousands of people being in on a hoax and all these space companies and all these governments and everyone lying about it? People from different from all different religions, all different political backgrounds, they're all in on this hoax for what reason, and how are they able to keep it a secret? But look at those two and say, which two of these positions requires that I make fewer assumptions? One is, like, okay, we've experimented with the world. This makes them, you know, sense within this model. The other has to appeal to, you know, massive cover-up, lies, conspiracy, and it doesn't account for everything else. And, you know, I haven't even asked you, you know, how do you account for the tides? How do you account for people who've taken pictures of the space station? You know, like Destin from Smarter Every Day did, you know, he's a Christian, and he took pictures of the space station crossing in front of the solar eclipse back when it happened. You know, there's people who take pictures of the ISS as it passes in front of the moon. You know, it's there's so many different pieces here that I think as you really start to unpack this, that there's things that, at least to me, doesn't make any sense with your model. But I would encourage you to really examine the other side of it and try to learn why is there consensus in these points, not just among secular scholars. I'm talking, like, if you go to NASA and you meet with a Christian rocket scientist or physicist, they're going to hold the same exact position that I'm, you know, bringing forth to you. And it's not faith demolishing for them. It's not like you have to give up your religious belief in order to accept this.
Right. Okay. It all makes sense. It's good. It's good stuff. I just have two more quick points, so we could just wrap it up, and because it just came into my head right now.
Yep. Make it as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I'll make it fast. You know how you spoke about like the ISS. So apparently there's a model of the ISS that NASA trains that it's like underwater in Olympic sized pool, and what has been caught is that they train there and they turn off the light to mimic the darkness of space, and then they start recording there because there's been times where air bubbles have been caught. So that's my first point. That they have a model that says an Olympic sized pool, they turn off the lights and they try to mimic the outer space scenario. And with air bubbles, they've been caught. And my other quick point is that when it comes to water and space, they're complete opposite, because water is pressure, it's trying to crush you, and in space you're trying to expand. So training in underwater, even if they're not faking it down there, makes no sense, because they're gonna go to a completely a different environment. It's like training in fire when you're actually gonna go and do the work in water. It's the complete opposite.
And what they're training for though is weightlessness, and the closest that we can get to low gravity for extended periods of time is a high buoyancy liquid like water, where you can actually float around. So it's not ideal, it's not perfect, but it's kind of the best we've got. If you're in, you know, an environment like space where you're floating around because there's no, you know, gravity, or at least low enough gravity that you float, that you're lighter than, you know, whatever else is around you, then it's like that's the closest that we can get to that is, hey, let's be inside of a substance, you know, a liquid like water, that, you know, is buoyant enough that we can swim around and float around. As far as the bubbles, I've seen right. some of the footage of that. I find it utterly unconvincing, because, you know, have you ever been in space? And if you haven't been in space, you don't even think space is real. You don't necessarily understand everything that's going into, you know, with like these, you know, dust particles that'll like fly off of things and stuff. And with cameras, the way that cameras will, you know, distort light and stuff and make things, you know, look spherical and stuff, like, there's so many different explanations that, like, if you don't understand the technology and how it works, and you don't understand the environment and how it works, it's really easy to jump to conclusions based off of what we do understand, but that doesn't mean it's accurate.
Thomas, I gotta be honest. I really think you need your own call-in show. You're really good at this.
Sorry, I'm hogging the mic.
No, you're good, man. Anytime you're on, I learn a lot. So it's awesome. Peter, thank you so much for taking the time.
Can I give my last point real quick?
It's got to be super quick because we have to wrap up.
Sure. So I said this last time. So we're in a vacuum, right? Allegedly. Well, first of all, the U.S. government actually has giant vacuum chambers, which is the reason, like, they don't train on those, is because it's way too dangerous. But instead of training on an Olympic pool, they can actually train on a vacuum chamber because they have them.
And they're not. It's not the vacuum that makes you weightless. It's that they're far enough away from Earth that the gravitational pull is less. Like if I'm in a vacuum, I'm not gonna, you know, if I hop into a vacuum chamber, I'm not gonna suddenly be able to float around.
Right. Okay. And so my last point was this. So Earth is an air bubble, and we're surrounded by the vacuum of space all over us, in all angles and all sides. But when we conduct tests here on Earth, if I get a small vacuum chamber and I blow an air bubble on it, it bursts. And then why doesn't that happen to Earth? Why doesn't our bubble burst? And the answer would be like, oh, it's because we have different atmospheres. We have the ozone layer.
We got to wrap up quickly, Peter.
But that's kind of like just saying, if I blow a bubble within a bubble, the first bubble is going to protect the second bubble, which is air can't protect air.
No, the reason that the atmosphere stays next to Earth is because Earth has a very, very strong gravitational pull. It's an absolutely gigantic object. And so it keeps like all of the, there's air in outer space. There is. It's very, very, very small. Like it's a tiny, you know, like you might have one particle in every like however many square meters. It's not enough to breathe. It's way less than you have inside of your body. So if you go floating through space, your body's going to explode. But on Earth, all of those particles that are floating around, they're drawn to the gravitational pull of Earth because Earth is absolutely huge. And so Earth is pulling everything in into it, including all of the, you know, oxygen and hydrogen and carbon dioxide and all of the different elements that make up our atmosphere. It's pulled in by the atmosphere. But there is, you know, if you go the further and further away you go, the thinner and thinner the atmosphere gets, and you go out into outer space and it's even less. But there still are molecules, you know, bouncing around of, you know, a little bit of oxygen here, a little bit of hydrogen there. It's just not enough to breathe or survive in.
All right, Peter. Okay. Thank you for taking the time to call in.
Thank you so much. Those were my points. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was fun.
All right. Have a good one.
Yeah. Thank you so much, guys. It's an honor. Thank you for always having me. You guys take care. God bless you. God bless your family and stay safe, guys. Love you guys.
You stay safe too. Before we get to our next caller, Jenner, like, what are your thoughts when people believe, you know, that many different conspiracies?
I mean, honestly, typically when people believe more than one, or when someone believes one conspiracy, they're more prone to believe another one. And what I've found is that oftentimes it comes from a position of distrust, distrust of the government, distrust of authority, distrust of experts, distrust of scientists, you know, big pharma, you name it, right? And I'm not saying, I would never tell someone that you should just have a blanket trust for all of these institutions. But when I started, you know, I label myself as a skeptic. I was distrustful of religion, but it wasn't my distrust of religion that like made me an atheist or made me, you know, leave my faith. It was more that like I wanted to know how the world worked.
Right.
And so I really, really started looking into how do we know the things that we know and why? What are the tests that we've run? What are the experiments that we've run? Why do experts have certain, you know, a consensus on certain things? Why are there some things in science where there isn't a consensus, where maybe 25% of the experts disagree wholeheartedly?
Right.
And when you start getting down into those things, you know, a lot of times it's a lot more difficult for me to wrap my head around because at that point you're getting really, really technical. But for things that, you know, have been consensus for decades or centuries even, there's usually a pretty good reason why everything else has been ruled out. And it's usually that there's been tests that have been run or that there's other things that these other models and these other theories don't account for, and that the best models that we have do account for them. That doesn't mean that the best models that we have are completely perfect or flawless or that they've accounted for everything or that there's no progress to be made. I think that that's preposterous just to say that. But some of these ideas, you know, the flat earth being one of them, is some of these ideas are things that have been completely, demonstrably, utterly ruled out. And, you know, there's ways that you can falsify these claims. And so, you know, if you have a new theory about, you know, scientists are trying to unify all of the forces of physics, right? And, you know, they're like, okay, we've got the standard model. And, you know, now we're learning about string theory. And now we're learning about, you know, quantum mechanics and stuff. And they're making these models for physics. They might find something or learn something that makes that model more accurate or that makes it account for more things and has greater explanatory power. But the flat earth is something that, like, unlike, you know, one of these models, like if they're trying to like disprove the standard model, they might come up with a test where they can falsify it. And if they run that test and it passes the test and it's not falsified, that doesn't mean that it's right. It just means that it hasn't been proven wrong. And so they come up with another test and they try it and it passes that test. And they come up with another one and all the tests that they throw at it, it passes. And, you know, there might be one thing that they can't explain or that they can't account for. And they're like, we need a better model. This accounts for all 99% of all these other things. But in this one scenario, there's this one fluke and we just are trying to wrap our heads around it. So they come up with a new theory that makes it go from 99% to 100%, you know, able to explain all of these things. And then it's a better, more accurate system. But the standard model still very, you know, precisely accounts for all of those other things that it has up until this point. We can still make these predictions and send rockets into space and land, you know, probes on comets and stuff. And we can do it consistently because these models work, because they have real world applications. And when you start looking at something like the flat earth, it doesn't have that same level of, you know, predictive power, of applicability. You know, we have ways to falsify it, and it has failed those tests time and time again.
Right.
You know, not to mention it has to appeal to, you know, massive conspiracy and fraud and hoaxes and the whole nine yards. So
want to get to, before we get to our next caller, Secular Rarity, thanks for the $5 super chat. Woo, I love this channel. Great stuff. And then the other shit, where did it go? Meet Matthew, $5 super chat. Imagining the atmosphere as a bubble is a terrible analogy. It's more like a droplet.
Mm.
All right, so our next caller is going to possibly prove that aliens are real, which I'm excited about. So, Cassidy, you are on with Thomas and Ethan. How are you?
Hey, Ethan. Good to meet you, Thomas.
Good to meet you.
How is everybody?
Doing well. So, why should we think aliens, in terms of like extraterrestrials, are real?
Well, I've been pondering that question most of the afternoon, and I really don't have a good answer for you as to why anyone should believe in extraterrestrials or at life outside of this biosphere exists. I mean, I can give you evidence till the cows come home, but it's nothing that you can't find, you know, a million other places. I think as far as should goes, I think the main reason why people should at least take it seriously is quite frankly because there are billions of dollars being spent to answer that very question and the consequences thereof. I mean, if extraterrestrials do exist, what is the nature of that life form? What are their intentions? What are they doing here? Do they even know humans exist? I mean, the fact that much effort, that much human effort is going to answer that question means it should be taken seriously, in my opinion. Now, I do have some evidence. I'm not going to call it proof. It's genetic evidence, but I'm not prepared to say proof yet. Working with the government on that.
Before you get to the evidence, I want to say that up until this point, I completely agree with you.
Oh, cool. Thanks.
Okay.
Now, what was the other thing?
No, that was it.
Continue.
You both talked at once.
Yeah, I don't remember what I was going to say.
Okay.
Go ahead. Continue.
Yeah, so I'm working with the government on the direct genetic evidence part. That's a long, kind of complex story. What I can say as far as that goes is the genetics are the facts. The why is what we're trying to find out. So now if
I'm traditionally believed,
if all the things going on in my head and the various starseed, you know, that whole subculture, if all these things that we are seeing, if there's even a chance that it's true, or that there's a, what I think is more likely, that there's like a sort of like a collective stimulus that we're all picking up somehow, you know? Anyway,
what do you mean a collective stimulus?
The point is, if there's a, well, I've been working with what's called starseeds for decades now. And the thing that strikes me the most is how consistent everyone's memories are. Not the ones that are looking for attention or trying to make up a story or looking to catch the bandwagon. But like, for example, the people that claim to have a past life with the Arcturians, for example, their descriptions of the lives, the culture, the biology, it's so consistent. You see what I mean?
I mean, I don't really. So, I think I know what you're trying to say, but I don't want to assume that you're saying what I think you're saying.
I don't know. Please go ahead. I have difficulty speaking.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing, and I want to make as strong of a representation of your case as possible. It sounds like you're saying to me that people who have these memories of past lives, who believe that they lived past lives in, you know, some type of alien or in some type of an alien culture or something, that there's people like this around the world who have very similar memories. Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I mean, I can give you some explanations, but I want to hear the rest of your case.
Oh, no, there's plenty of explanations. I'm not here to make a case. I'm here to present a theory. Okay. And yes, it is a theory, not a hypothesis. Thank you very much. I do know the difference. Anyway,
okay.
No, it's not just memories. It's also like collections of consistent mutations, like going back to the quote unquote Arcturians again. You know, a distressing number of these of the people that are claiming to have these memories are experiencing sort of a, like a cavitation in the center of their forehead. This is consistent with quote unquote Arcturian biology. You see what I mean? What I'm saying quote unquote, because I'm having to group these different sections of people by more or less science fiction names, like Arcturian, Pleiadian, Lyran. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, take Betty and Barney Hill, right? I'm sure you've heard of Betty and Barney Hill.
I've heard of them, yeah.
Okay, so, all right. Now, Betty Hill described in her memory speaking to the people that took her, and she asked them a question. She said, "Where are you from?" They pointed to the star that humans know as Zeta Reticuli, right? Mm-hmm. So now, even before Betty and Barney Hill's story became famous, there were other people reporting the Zeta Reticuli aspect of all this, okay? Now, does that mean that there's little green men coming from Zeta Reticuli? No. What that means is there is some common stimulus amongst all these experiencers. Okay. What my family and I are trying to work with the United States government on is discovering the origin of this. Okay. Now to this effect, we are in possession of a mutated genome, for lack of a better word. This genome was previously learning disabilities and whatnot.
I just want to clarify, when you say we're in possession, are you saying that like all of our genes are mutated, or are you saying that you have a particular sample?
No, my family specifically, mine, my daughter's, my mother's, etc.
Okay. How can we see? Well, I'm sorry, I'll let you continue.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, how can we see that you have some type of mutated DNA?
I'm assuming sequencing.
Working on that, I'm working on that. I have to get the appropriate paperwork signed by the geneticist working on my daughter's case. Basically, we had to go through a lot of channels and a lot of steps to get to this part. Basically, this all got proven when my daughter's heart failed, and she needed to go in, and they discovered that her heart was literally just shutting off. And when they were just trying to figure out why, they took genetic tests and they found this, you know, genome. I've known about it my whole life. I've been working with it my whole life since I was about 5 years old. This goes back to like the old 70s guru culture that my mother and father were part of. So it wasn't news for me. They found this gene in me when I was 21. And it's just, I have a really severe head injury, so there's nothing they could do about it. You know, they couldn't study it. There's nothing they could do in my case. My daughter, however, she doesn't have any brain injuries. She has no flaws, no learning disabilities, no nothing. She is essentially a perfect brain.
Why couldn't they study your genome?
They've been able to study.
Like, why couldn't they study your, because your genetic material is all over your body. Like, you can take out, you know, a blood sample or something, you can spit into a tube and your genome is contained in the DNA in that bit of spittle. Like, that's what you send off to like 23andMe in these DNA tests. Why would your brain injury preclude you from being able to test that?
Well, I'm sorry that you cut out for a second. What?
You said that you couldn't get your DNA tested because you had a brain injury, and I'm confused by that.
No. I couldn't get the genome studied because I have a brain injury. So it's not a good model. It's not a control group. You know what I mean?
I don't see how physical damage to the brain would affect your DNA.
Yeah, I'm kind of confused on that as well.
It doesn't affect the DNA. What I'm saying is that normally when humans, when they find this genome in a person, it's associated with a learning disorder. Okay, like a, you know, like a learning disability, a flaw in the brain.
Okay.
We don't have these flaws. Okay, so we basically have the good without the bad. They couldn't study my brain because I have, like I said, this very severe traumatic brain injury. My daughter Char does not.
Okay.
They're able to study the way she views the world, IQ tests, the whole nine yards. So that's where we're working with the government on. And that's essentially the why is the question, not the what.
What the government DNA department is are you working with? Fact.
Okay, it exists in many, many, many people. Point of fact, the latest I heard from Charles Geneticist is that the theory is that you'll find this in shaman bloodlines from indigenous people.
So
that goes back into
Cassidy. Who, to echo what Thomas was saying, who are you working with on this at the government level? And is it possible for us to get involved and start reviewing any like documentation you have on this?
Yes. If somebody could help me get the paperwork like signed and released, then yeah, they agreed to release anything that they have on the off chance that something could be found to help Char. They're really desperate to help my daughter.
When you say they, who are you referring to?
United States government.
Who in the government? What department? AMA. The AMA?
American
Medical Association?
Yeah.
So it's like a health, like health tests.
Well, and that's how it started, because we had to take her into the emergency room because her heart stopped. And it, like I said, when they found the genome, when they were doing a genetic test to find out why her heart was stopping, mm-hmm. they never did find the reason why her heart was stopping, but they did find the genes. So Char is the first person that they've been able to study that has full cognitive capabilities mm-hmm. with this genomic differential.
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely believe you. I human mutations and DNA and stuff happen all the time. Did the AMA say that there was reason to believe that this was extraterrestrial?
No, that's not them. They're still trying to find the origin of it. They're trying to track it down. They found the genetics in a number of archaeological samples and things like that. They're trying to track down the origin of it. The angle that I'm bringing to it, and I've discussed this with them. It's been a wild ride. They had to have me psych evaluated, checked for schizophrenia and everything. It was awesome. But the angle I'm bringing to it is if the memories, the training, the culture is true, then this is something that needs to be looked at. As I'm given to understand that the figure known as Valiant Thor had a treaty with Eisenhower. If this is true, I saw this on Ancient Aliens, so who knows, okay? But if this is true, and I mean, that's, I owe Eisenhower a debt for my daughter, do you see? Because it's really hard to explain, and I don't speak well.
No, okay, so I know you keep saying you don't speak well, but you do, you speak just fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with what you're, well, yeah, there are a few things wrong with what you're saying that I don't necessarily agree with, but you're speaking clearly.
Cool.
Thomas is completely frozen. Give me 1 second. Okay, so what right now do you have in your possession that we could review to try and substantiate some of what you're claiming? Because from this perspective, it's incredibly difficult to wrap my mind around what you're telling me.
Yeah, I've been doing a show on this for 4 years and people are still confused.
it's a lot. It's a lot to absorb.
Go ahead.
It's a lot to absorb. So it's, to me, like when I make claims, I think it's really important to provide, sources and back them up in any way I can. So I'm wondering, do you currently have anything in your possession right now that we could review?
I don't know how you would review it on the show, but I shared with you the MRI that shows what I do. I share my people's technology.
Okay.
And 30 years of this is my proof.
send me a message with everything you've got. I will then see if I can find a doctor, with your permission, of course, to review said MRI and get us any information possible on it. Would you be willing to provide provide me as much documentation as you can?
I'm willing to provide everything that I've got. Basically, awesome. I'm on the journey to figure out what exactly is going on. And I can't do that if I'm like clinging to a particular perspective.
Well played. Very well played. So are you open to the possibility that you could be wrong here?
Oh, yes. Oh, God, I hope I'm wrong.
Well, that's...
Oh, I hope I'm wrong even.
You know, that's
okay, if I'm...
Go ahead.
Okay, so far everything in the model is played out completely accurately, including the beer virus coming out of the Gobi Desert. If this is all true, right? If this is all true, if everything that I can see and document and interact with is 100% true, we are in big trouble. We are in really big trouble. We need to come together as a people yesterday. Okay.
Okay.
So yeah, I hope I'm wrong. I really hope I'm wrong.
All right.
I'm gonna be honest, dude. I put all this stuff in the science fiction format because that's all I thought it was until all this started to come true.
Well,
and so I share what I do. I share what I do, and yeah, that's what
I appreciate you taking the time to call in, wait on hold, and share all this with us. If you wouldn't mind, go ahead and Facebook me everything you have, and I will see if I can get any experts to review it, and maybe we can get some more answers to this. So, Cassidy, thank you so much for taking the time to call in today.
Yep, thank you for being patient with my rambling.
Absolutely.
Have a good day, Ethan.
You have a good one. Nice talking to you. So Thomas had an internet outage. Unfortunately, he dropped. We are doing a Discord after show. I don't know if Thomas is going to be in it or not at this point. He's working on his internet. For those that don't know, if one of our mods will go ahead and put, oh, Stan, you like my shirt? Here, let me show you the whole thing. I have a whole collection of pretty awesome streaming shirts. So yeah, if you're interested, we all go to Discord after this show and do like a wrap-up talk about how it went, talk about the callers and so on. Just so you know, every Thursday I host another show with Hannah Vaughn, which is Thomas Westbrook's partner, called The Pickup Line, where we talk dating, relationships, and sex. And it's at 9 p.m. Central on this channel every single week. And this week we are talking about swingers parties, and we're bringing on none other than Dr. Daryl Ray to join us for the conversation. Then August 14th, I will have nearly every single ACA host on YFNA for an ACA fundraiser. I'm talking the hosts of the Atheist Experience, Truth Wanted, the nonprofits, Secular Sexuality, Talk Heathen. They're all, almost all, going to be here on YFNA, and I cannot wait for that. It'll be at 7 p.m. Central. And then what I'm most, I can't say most excited, just say really excited about. For those who don't know, have you seen the Karate Kid 3 movie? Well, do you remember the villain in it, Mike Barnes, the guy who beats up Daniel LaRusso? I am interviewing him on YFNA at the end of the month. I should have the date like right in front of me. August 25th. The link is on my channel. You can click it, get reminder, and it'd be cool if you could check it out. And then also I want to thank my top tier patrons, Cindy Plaza, Kenneth Leonard, Kathy Leto, Jump and Shoot Oz, Secular Rarity, Kianta and Fava Beans, Philip Leach, Caitlin Beyond, Toast, Richard Gilliver, Sunset Sarge, Kyle Brewer. Thank you all for your patronage. If you like what I do, consider becoming a patron for as low as $1 a month, because believe it or not, running YouTube channels does cost money, especially the phone lines. So everyone, thanks for watching. I hope everyone has a safe and wonderful week, and we will see you on Thursday. Good night. Oh, and join us in Discord right now.